You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is rock historian Tom Doyle. His Paul McCartney book is one of the best of the many books out there on the Wings frontman. And now Tom Doyle shines a spotlight on one Reginald Dwight, better known to all of us as the rock star Elton John. The new book is called Captain Fantastic, Elton John's Stellar Trip Through the 70s. Tom Doyle, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to talk to you again. And I really enjoyed this book, and I think all of my listeners will love it too. And it's like your McCartney book in that it focuses on just a select period of time in a long career.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose I'm really interested in the sort of decade-specific book, you know, because a lot of the time in a decade, I mean, like all of our lives, I mean, if you look back at a decade in your life, you know, there usually is a sort of start point, and then, you know, particularly with both these books, the end point actually wasn't the end of the decade, and it was 1981. And for some reason, it's just that's kind of how the narrative arc went. But I think, you know, in the case of the McCartney book, obviously, it was a very difficult era for him because he was trying to escape the shadow of the Beatles, whereas the 70s for Elton really were the time when he made himself. And I think the thing that's most surprising, you know, for people who don't know the story is really how close it came to not happening. Because in August 1970, I mean, Elton was thinking about giving up. He'd put out two albums in the UK, both of which had tanked. And really, he was thinking about giving up and becoming a keyboard player. He was going to accept an offer to become the keyboard player for Jeff Beck. And it was his music publisher, Dick James, who was the guy who'd made his money with the Beatles and Northern Songs and stuff. He actually turned around to him and said, look, you know, we've got this last throw of the dice, which is go over to America, play these shows that you've been offered at the Troubadour. And actually what they'd done, Dick James had licensed the album to Uni Records in the States, which was like a tiny little off-print of MCA. And basically, this was the last throw the dice. And Elton himself thought, well, you know, if these shows do nothing, which he actually expected they would, then at least I'll be able to go to America, where he'd never been before, and buy some records.
Yeah, he was an avid record collector.
Well, this is it. So that was his main thing in his mind, was I can go and buy records actually made in America, which was the biggest thrill to him, really, more than the idea of going and performing at the Troubadour. But what happens at the Troubadour, really, is thanks to Uni, really, sort of pumping up expectation ahead of his appearance. On the opening night, the Troubadour is completely packed, and there's various celebrities there and stuff. And everybody really, listening to Elton's album, particularly his second album, the self-titled album, you know, and it's quite a, you know, it's a piano-heavy, almost classically influenced record. And so people imagined that perhaps he was, you know, in the style of, you know, the singer-songwriters of that era and stuff. But he gets up on the stage and he just absolutely hammers into these songs, because really, with a three-piece band and without the orchestrations that were on the record, there was nothing else he could do. So, I mean, he's set to stun, and he really did.
Well, Robert Hilburn, he's been a guest here on From the Bookshelf, and he's the former rock critic for the L.A. Times, and he's a great guy, although when I lived in L.A. in the 70s, I found him often infuriating. And in fact, I found him infuriating when I was talking to him here on From the Bookshelf. He often gets things, you know, terribly wrong, but he did play a major role in launching Elton John, right?
Yeah, well, this is it, because, I mean, he was there the first night, and then he wrote this thing for the L.A. Times, this review, which Elton in the book describes to me as a turbo review. I mean, it really was rejoice, rock music has a new star. And really what happened after this review appeared was it sort of spread through all the different cities. And then suddenly, you know, I mean, Elton, I don't think he ever appeared on it, but he's getting calls from, like, the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, I mean, this absolutely made him. It was this one review that Robert Hilburn wrote that absolutely made him. I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, if that hadn't appeared, even if he'd wowed that little pocket of L.A., and the sort of Los Angeles, you know, music knowledge people, it's hard to see how that would have crossed over, really, without this review. But as Elton says, it was a turbo review and it spread to everywhere. And it was incredible what happened. I mean, within 2 months, the band and Dylan, right, were appearing at shows, or at least, you know, coming, not on stage, you know, but coming along as fans and saying, you know, we love this stuff, you know. And by Christmas of that year, so really, you know, just a few months after he was thinking about giving up, he appeared on the Andy Williams show, duetting with one of his biggest heroes, Ray Charles. So it was the absolute breakneck speed that this happened at that really was amazing. So it's an incredible beginning of the 70s for Elton.
Well, let's take a page from Mojo magazine. Now, this book actually began as a series of articles for Mojo. Is that right?
That's right, yes. I mean, what happens was, I mean, these days, I mean, access to particularly superstars is, you know, sometimes limited, and, you know, you have to get everything that you need for these articles in the space of sometimes 45 minutes, an hour, or whatever. With Elton, he seemed to be very generous with his time, and, you know, these conversations, basically, there was too much. I mean, I actually found myself with too much, and it was one of those things that, you know, the articles were pretty long, really, but there was still no room. I mean, for instance, I mentioned this in the book, when Elton in 76 met Elvis Presley, and it was this incredible time where both of them are sort of suffering from declines in different ways, because Elton had been over touring and, you know, had been a phenomenal success, obviously. And Elvis, obviously, is suffering from a major decline of his own at that point. Anyway, the both of them meet, and there's this incredible little story about it, and I couldn't find room in the articles to use this. So it was, that was actually the sort of light bulb above the head moment where I thought, right, this is it. This is a book.
Well, that's pretty great, and I want to ask you more about talking to all the people that you talk to, including Elton. But what I was going to say is, in Mojo magazine, one of the things I love in Mojo is in the very last page of most issues, they have this thing called Hello and Goodbye, in which they talk about a band and they tell you how the band started and then they tell you how it ended. And so it seems to me there's sort of a hello, goodbye happening in this book, even though Elton's career, of course, goes on for a long time. But this golden era that begins with the Robert Hilburn article kind of ends with this gig that he did in England where he did play Captain Fantastic all the way through. Tell us a little bit about that day.
Yeah, well, I mean, Captain Fantastic, the album, I mean, for me, is actually my favourite album of Elton's 1970s. I just think it was one of these things. I mean, he was making his albums very quickly because he had this, really, it was almost like a 1960s deal where you would have to make two albums a year. And so Elton, all the way through the 70s, is making two albums a year to fulfil this contract. And this means that sometimes it's an amazing thing because spontaneity and not overthinking things lead him to creating some amazing things. And then sometimes you get sort of slightly ropey albums, you know, Caribou's not a favourite of mine and stuff like that. But Captain Fantastic, they took a bit more time over it. I mean, not much longer, but it was an autobiographical record, which basically looked back at his and Bernie Taupin, his lyricist partner's, early days of struggling in London. And it's a beautiful record, really. And for me, I mean, being a huge Beatles fan and stuff like that, it's for me, it's his most sort of Beatles-esque record. There's not a big hits on there. I mean, Someone Saved My Life Tonight is on there, and that's probably the biggest tune on there. But anyway, it's a beautiful record, but he decides, right, to play this in full. Now, I mean, obviously, cocaine had entered the picture by this point, right, so there's maybe a little bit of hubris involved in this, right, where he plays Wembley Stadium, which in London is massive. I mean, it's like 72,000 people, right, turning out to see Elton on a Saturday afternoon. And I've actually spoken to people who were at the gig, and they say that it was a real damp squib, because basically the Beach Boys, who were kind of on and up again, because they were surfing a wave, literally, right, of 60s nostalgia, you know, so they're getting up there, and they're doing I Get Around, and, you know, and all the big hits and stuff like that. And then Elton comes on and says, hey, right, we're going to play all this new album in sequence, which had only been out for a few weeks. And so people were actually leaving as he was playing. And, I mean, obviously, this is a torturous thing for a performer, because if you can see from the stage that people are actually leaving, what do you do? Do you think to yourself, right, let's stop this, right, in the middle, even though I've just said we're going to play the whole album, let's stop this in the middle and bang into Crocodile Rock. But you can't do that, because then you're admitting in the there and now, right, that you've made a mistake. So they kept on playing it, kept on playing it. But by the time it was finished, I mean, apparently the audience was quite sparse by this point. And there was a Melody Maker headline the week after that basically just said, look, he tanked, you know, and the Beach Boys, I think it was their cup runneth over, and Elton's left to pick up the empty.
How sad.
Which is really cruel, actually, isn't it?
Of course, he was really ahead of his time, because nowadays that's a big thing to go and do a whole album. You know, groups do it all the time now.
Yeah, but usually it's a classic album, you know. Usually it's something that people already know, and it can be a bit of a nostalgia trip. Or if you look at the case of U2 and the Joshua Tree at the moment, I mean, that's a very clever tour, really, because that was a record that was made at a certain difficult political time in the 80s. And they've revived it in the era of Trump. So, I mean, that is, they see that as being a relevant comment on what's happening now. But it's a very tough thing. I mean, I have sometimes seen, I mean, I remember seeing Neil Young when he did, what was that album, Greendale?
Yeah, Greendale.
Which was a really terrible record anyway, you know.
Yeah.
And I saw him play that, the whole thing, right, at Hammersmith Odeon in London. And honestly, I mean, I was with my wife, right, and even when he came back on at the end, and did all the classics and stuff like that. I mean, she was so sick of it by that point. She was like, I just want to go. And I was like, wait a minute. No, he's playing Heart of Gold now, you know, and now he's going to be after the Gold Rush. So it just sort of shows you how, you know, artists can test the patience of their audience, you know. And Captain Fantastic is a difficult record in the sense that if you are just standing there, say you were hearing it for the first time, it's a lot of sort of mid-paced ballads, a lot of reminiscence on the past and stuff like that. So if you've just been punching the air to the Beach Boys and you've had quite a few beers, then listening to this stuff, this mid-paced stuff, is maybe really not what you want to hear.
So did this bad concert experience have a lasting effect on Elton John?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't blame it specifically on that concert, actually. I would think, I mean, that was, say, in the book, that was a sign that his you know, the course of his fantastic voyage was starting to drift off. Because until that point, I mean, he'd never really set a foot wrong. I think really that what happened was, it was because of these two albums a year, and also the incredible fame. I mean, we forget really how famous he was, actually, particularly in America. I mean, he was the true successor, really, to the Beatles, and it's just this unbroken run of number one albums, two albums a year being made and released, and also in the middle of this, absolutely constant touring, you know, so there was never any time off, which is fine. He was a young dude, he was in his 20s, but then he starts to prop himself up with cocaine because, I mean, the rest of the band are doing it, and he thinks, yeah, I'll take a little sniff. Next thing, off he goes, you know, doing this, using it to, as bands used to do in the 60s when they used to, like, pop speed and stuff like that to keep the touring schedule going. In the 70s, he's doing this. Loads of coke, private jets, blah, blah, blah. And I think by the time it got to 76, he was just worn out. He was emotionally spent. And he decides, basically, to quit touring and announces this from the stage of Madison Square Garden. And there's cries of, no, no, in the audience and stuff. And then he doesn't really seem that sure if he wants to do it, because the next year he sets up another gig at Wembley Arena in London, which is sort of the smaller Wembley. That's like the arena. And, you know, as opposed to the stadium that we were talking about previously. And anyway, he gets up on the stage and he's agreed to do this gig and stuff like that, and then just doesn't seem to be into it, and announces yet again that he's quitting. And his manager is like punching walls backstage. It's like, wait a minute, I thought he said, you know. So it was this thing that, I think it was like a love-hate relationship with the touring thing, and he was just wiped out too.
So the first farewell tour and the second farewell tour.
The never-ending farewell tour.
You know, I didn't see Elton during the 70s, in the era in which you write about, and he did all those crazy costumes and staged things. But I did see him maybe 10 years later at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco, and he was just him at the piano running through his greatest hits. And it was a very uninspired performance, even though he was playing all of the songs that you would most, you know, choose to hear, you know, kind of a jukebox of Elton John. It wasn't very good.
You know, this, that was a tough time for him, actually. He talks about this in the book, in the epilogue of the book, because actually, yeah, that would have been, I think the first time I saw Elton live was in about 1989. And the 80s were a tough time for him because the cocaine thing became like a real problem at that point. And he does actually say that, you know, he, I mean, before then, in the 70s, he was kind of on it and stuff like that. And then it's just, you know, by the 80s, the coke was sort of on him, you know. So I think, I mean, when I saw him, actually, yeah, it wasn't a great show either. I mean, it was going through the motions. And, you know, he admits this in the book. He said, you know, when you're performing on coke, it's a terrible thing because you become really paranoid. You know, are the audience liking it? Is this tempo too, is it right? Is the song too fast? Is it too slow? You know, so I think, I mean, obviously, this is the point where it wasn't helping to fuel his creativity or his performances, but it was actually killing them, you know. So I mean, actually, I mean, I don't know when you saw him. I saw him at 89, and really, you know, I mean, it was kind of the worst time to see him because it was at his worst point. And then it wasn't until 1990 that he actually thought, right, no, that's it, I'm checking in rehab. And that's when things got better. I mean, if you see Elton now, I mean, he still plays all the hits and stuff like that. His voice is in pretty good shape and stuff. He's got the original band back, you know, so it's a much more rewarding experience and much more a sort of mirror of what he would have been like in the 70s.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no. Or a man who makes potions in a traveling ship.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Tom Doyle. He's the author of Captain Fantastic, Elton John's Stellar Trip Through the 70s. We'll continue our conversation right after this. Well, Tom Doyle, when you wrote this new book about Elton John, which is called Captain Fantastic, Elton John's Stellar Trip Through the 70s, you interviewed lots of people, including Elton John and Bernie Taupin as well, right? What kind of guys?
That's right, yeah.
Tell me about them. What kind of people are they?
Bernie is really interesting because he was somebody who was completely reluctant to become famous. And this is actually, I mean, you hear this sometimes, right, from people who are sidemen. You know, it's like, I don't want to be famous, I just want to write the songs and stuff. But I think genuinely, right, he really didn't want to be in the spotlight. I mean, there's this one great bit in a TV documentary that was filmed for Britain in about 71, 72. And Elton brings Bernie out on the stage, and you've never seen somebody. He is literally a rabbit in the headlights. He's just like, get me off here, you know. So Bernie was in a really unique position, actually, because of the fact that he was suddenly a multimillionaire, but he was relatively anonymous. I mean, his photographs are on the covers, you know, featured somewhere in the artwork of the albums and stuff. So he was known. But he says that, I mean, these days, nobody knows who he is at all. But Bernie's great. He's got a brilliant sense of humour, actually, as you would have to have, you know, being in this sort of unique situation. But it was a strange thing there, because even though he was off the stage, he was on the tours. So he would kind of be backstage with nothing to do. So he starts drinking more and more, and then he indulges in all the things that the rest of the band were indulging in. So he ended up, you know, with various, you know, drug habits and all this sort of stuff, you know. So, and that's, it gets to this point in 76 where they, you know, they make the album Blue Moves, and Bernie's going through a divorce at the time, so the lyrics are really depressing, and Elton, you know, actually for the first time turns around to him and says, look, Bernie, I can't sing some of this stuff, and rejects some of his lyrics. So at that point, they sort of split, but not for long. I mean, they, you know, they go away and they have sort of creative dalliances with other people. But, yeah, but by 79, they're back together again. Yeah, but Bernie was really interesting. I mean, some of the other people that I interviewed for the book, I mean, obviously, Kiki D, who had the Don't Go Break My Heart huge thing with Elton, and she was like Elton's protege, and very funny, because she's really shy and stuff like that as well, and you can see that there's a really shy side to Elton as well, and she said that both of them, that's kind of what they had in common. But she remembers him taking her into these fancy sort of stores in New York and just buying her, lavishing all these gifts on her, buying her really expensive dresses and all this sort of stuff, you know. So, and this is, you know, there's a lot of interesting characters who are kind of forgotten in the story, actually. And one of them is this guy, Legs Larry Smith, who was one of my favourite interviews for the book, actually, because he's just hilarious. And he was, just to give you a bit of backstory, he was in the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, who were a sort of parody 60s band. And they were, you know, like the Beatles were massive fans of them and stuff, and they appear in a scene in Magical Mystery Tour and stuff. But anyway, Larry was the tap dancer in this band. So he would sort of clack around the stage tap dancing, and then he eventually became the drummer. But then the band split up because, you know, they had various problems themselves. And Elton was a huge fan of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, so he takes Larry on tour as a tap dancer, right? And really just as a foil, right? Just as, you know, I think he was to want to inject a bit of humour into the band. But what Larry does is, because he is so flamboyant in his stage wear and sort of full camp, you know, so, I mean, Larry's not gay, but he's sort of English theatrical darling, you know, one of these sort of characters. And he's brilliant. And what he does is he sort of slightly, just bit by bit by bit, encourages Elton to go further and further and further with the flamboyance in terms of his stage wear. And, I mean, they end up doing this number. It's like a big camp singing in the rain sort of thing on the tour, right? And he's kind of forgotten, actually, Larry, in the story, in the sense that everybody just thinks, oh, you know, Elton just started off, you know, mousy edge, and then he just came out of the shell more and more as the 70s progressed. But actually, Legs Larry Smith is a major influence on this. So it was amazing, really, to sit down with him, and he's describing in the book some of his costumes and stuff, which are just, you know, they're sort of like, I mean, he looks like he could have been in, you know, Frank Zappa's Mothers or something, you know. I mean, it's not, he's not like a theatrical queen or whatever. It's like sort of flamboyant, hippie, chic, you know. But anyway, you know, I mean, the readers, I won't even attempt to describe some of the stuff that he wears. But he actually tap dances in front of the Queen Mother at a Royal Variety performance with Elton. And I mean, it really, it must have been the most bizarre sight, you know, to be in that audience, you know, surrounded by all these people who were completely, it's all the rich, the super rich, the royalty of England, right? And this hippie is up there, you know, tap dancing, you know, with a bridal veil and stuff. But Elton loved this, and obviously, so he was a key figure in sort of projecting Elton's image.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Elton's image and his sexuality. I mean, was he closeted even from himself, or, you know, at what point did he realize that he was gay, and at what point did he come out of the closet?
Well, I mean, I think it's one of those things. I mean, I'm sure with people who are in that situation, it's a sort of slow realization sometimes. And for him, I mean, particularly in the 60s, I mean, you've got to remember, like, homosexuality in England was illegal. So, I mean, there were many more reasons other than, you know, not wanting to tell your parents or whatever. I mean, it was illegal. So, I mean, it was one of those things that you just think, well, I'm telling no one about this. But he did, when he was younger and he was travelling in and out of London, he said that he would, you know, he would be sitting on the underground train, like, eyeing up the guys rather than the girls. And he thought, right, okay. So what happened was, I mean, I think he was in denial, and his first sort of relationship was with a guy who was going to become his manager, right? John Reid, the Scottish record executive dude. And it actually happened, it's a very eventful trip, this first trip to America for Elton, because after the Troubadour shows, the band fly up to San Francisco, and John Reid is in town. He's working for Motown, and they're having their anniversary celebrations in San Francisco. And so they'd met before and stuff, and then they get together, and then they really get together. So, I mean, this is, so he kept it all quiet, you know, because then obviously John Reid becomes his manager, so he's in a relationship with his manager. And there were rumours throughout the 70s, but then it was pretty easy to sort of fly under the radar in terms of your sexuality in the 70s, because all the men were wearing makeup, right? All the men were, you know, experimenting with sexuality in terms of androgyny and stuff. I mean, you look at, like, David Bowie, who admitted to his bisexuality when really, I mean, I think he was only a dabbler. I mean, the guy was straight. Elton was the opposite, actually, right? So he's got girls sort of screaming at him and all this sort of stuff. But, I mean, inside, he knows he's gay, and he's obviously, he's in this relationship with his manager. So all the way, there are rumours throughout the 70s, and it's only in 76 when there's a reporter from Rolling Stone in the middle of an interview dares to ask him, actually, and says, look, will I put the tape off? Right? And Elton says to me in the book, well, I knew what was coming. And he said, no, don't put the tape off. Right? And so this, the reporter, he kind of picks around it and just, you know, just to see, like trying to pull a thread to see if anything unravels or whatever. And Elton admits to bisexuality at this point. And there's a pretty immediate and pretty strange effect, actually, because when Bowie had done it, people just sort of thought it added to his sort of alien cool and all this sort of stuff. And obviously, Bowie's record buyers were all the sort of hip and all this sort of stuff, you know. Whereas a lot of Elton's record buyers were sort of conservative middle America. And some of these took great exception to this. And some of the more conservative radio stations stopped playing his records and stuff. So as a result of him coming out as bisexual, when he was actually gay, it sort of dented his career around 76, 77. But then at the same time, what Elton says to me in the book is, you know, it was a small price to pay for the amount of freedom that it bought me sort of going on into the future. So there's the liberation of saying, look, this is what I am, like it, don't like it, buy my records, don't buy my records, whatever, right, was a massive amount of freedom for him. And obviously now, you know, he's, you know, the guy's a gay icon, so, I mean, it was one of the best things that he could have done, but obviously a very rocky thing and brave thing to do.
We're talking with Tom Doyle, and he's just written this great book about Elton John, and it's called Captain Fantastic, Elton John's Stellar Trip Through the 70s. And it wasn't all fun. I mean, he was suicidal at a couple of different points in the story.
Yeah, there are a couple of suicide attempts. I mean, one of them serious and one of them not so serious. I mean, in sort of in the late 60s, basically, he decides that, I mean, I think he always wanted a family, Elton, right? So he meets this girl, this is before he's come out or before he's met John Reed and stuff like that, and he meets this girl and he sort of suddenly finds himself railroaded into this marriage. And he's living at this point with this girl Linda, and he's also sharing the flat in London with Bernie Taupin. And one day, you know, Elton's just absolutely despairing, doesn't want to go through with this marriage and stuff like that, and he decides to gas himself. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's a preposterous suicide attempt, because really what he does is he puts the gas oven on low, doesn't light it, and then leaves the windows open. So, I mean, it's one of those things. He rests his head on this pillow, and obviously he must know that somebody else is in the house, and Bernie finds him. And so it's a massive cry for help. I mean, I said to Elton, I said, was that a serious suicide attempt? He went, kind of half and half, you know. But it doesn't sound as if it was. I mean, it sounds like he was in a really desperate situation and was looking for any way to get out of it, and maybe felt as if this sort of, oh my God, he's suicidal, let's call the marriage off, would have worked, which it didn't in the end, and it took a sort of drunken bust-up to end that situation, you know, which obviously would have been a very different path for him and might have actually killed his career or nipped it in the bud, put it that way. But the second one happens in 1975 in Los Angeles, and this is the height of Elton mania, basically. And Los Angeles had declared that this week in October will be Elton John Week, you know, so there's all these different things going on. He's unveiling his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He's got two shows at the Dodger Stadium, which are, like, record-breaking, you know. And in between these things, I mean, basically what he's done is he's flown over all his family from England and employees and stuff. He's actually chartered a plane, you know, in this you know, hugely extravagant move. And anyway, he's sitting around with his family, or his family at least, are sitting around the pool of his mansion in L.A. And he comes stumbling out the house and just announces to everybody that he's taken 60 pills and that he's going to be dead within the hour, and throws himself in the pool. And obviously it's a really, yet again, a very dramatic thing to do. But I mean, I think this one was a bit more serious, really, because, I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, putting the gas oven on at low is one thing, but, I mean, actually taking 60 Valium pills, you don't know, right? I mean, they slow down your nervous system. I mean, you don't know by the time you get your stomach pumped, right, if they'll have actually done you such permanent damage, right, or to your system, right? They would slow down your breathing, slow down your heart rate, and kill you, you know? So I think this was a really, you know, quite a serious, serious moment. And incredibly, I mean, obviously, you know, obviously he survived it and stuff, but what was more incredible was that 2 days later, he managed to play both the Dodger shows. And really, if you see photographs or footage from these shows, no one at all, apart from those completely in the know, would have been able to tell the sort of despair that he'd been going through. But yet again, I asked him about this in the book, and he said, like, you know, it's just overwork, being immature, just trying to deal with things in a preposterous way. And really, that was a massive cry for help, rather. But, I mean, quite a serious one, I would say. It could have ended in real tragedy in 1975 that weekend. And I mean, imagine if that had happened. I mean, this huge celebration is going on, Elton John week and stuff like that, and he kills himself in the middle of it. So it just shows you the dramas, the, you know, the sort of skyscraping highs and then the plummeting lows that he, you know, managed to endure throughout the 70s.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Tonight we're talking with rock historian Tom Doyle, whose new book, A Biography of Elton John. Let's talk a little bit about, speaking of highs and lows, the highs and lows of the records. You were mentioning that there was, you know, two records a year. And I want to specifically talk for a second about Bernie Taupin's lyrics. I mean, you know, a lot of his songs are great. There's no two ways about it. But some of his lyrics maybe are not so great, even on some of the hit records. When you were telling the story about his abortive suicide attempt with his first fiance who had become pregnant, it seems to me that lyric, I was telling my wife this story, and that how Someone Saved My Life Tonight is part of this autobiographical album, Captain Fantastic. And she said, well, that lyric, that doesn't seem very fair to her. I mean, she didn't almost have her hooks in him, and it makes her sound like a very scheming type.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah. I mean, like, whatever the situation was, I mean, only the two of them will ever really know, you know, who was calling the shots in that relationship. But yeah, I think in the book I described it, I think I said that Bernie had painted her with unfair cartoon grotesquerie, right? Because it's just, I mean, she's almost in this lyric, she's like Cruella de Vil or something, right? You know, she's coming for your puppies, man, you know what I mean? So it's... the thing with Bernie's lyrics, and because this all comes back again to this two-album-a-year thing, they were writing these songs so fast, and sometimes, I mean, you know yourself, if you write something fast, sometimes it turns out great, you know, sometimes it's, most of the time, it can be a bit slipshod, you know, and Bernie admits that, you know, some of the lyrics, I mean, you know, I won't swear, but, I mean, he says that, you know, some of the lyrics are not about a lot, you know. Whereas some of them are more crafted, and they're clearly, I mean, you look at Candle in the Wind, I mean, you can say it's mawkish or whatever, but it's incredibly evocative or whatever. Goodbye Yellow Brick Road's an amazing lyric. I mean, it really is. And that song in particular, I mean, you could imagine that having sat on Sgt. Pepper or Magical Mystery Tour. It's real sort of 67 Beatles sort of vibe, you know. But yeah, I mean, some of them, I mean, particularly in that Someone Saved My Life Tonight tune, yeah, it's one side of a story, but I mean, it's, that's the interesting thing, was that a lot of the time I think that Bernie, in the early days, he was just writing about whatever he wanted to, and then later on he was trying to sort of channel Elton's thoughts, because obviously he knew that Elton would be singing them. And also he didn't want to make them, if it was a love song, he didn't want to make them gender specific, because obviously he knows that Elton's gay. So it's just like for, you know, Elton to get up there and sing I Love Her Doobie Doobie Doo, you know, wasn't going to kind of work, you know. So I think it was that the amount of material that Benny was really churning out, you know, and some of it was churning it, really, you know. I mean, they worked in the this place in the Chateau in France, Chateau de Harouville it's called, just outside Paris. And really what would happen was Benny would be sitting up in his room and he'd be writing or typing a lyric, and then he would take it down to the breakfast table for Elton, and Elton would sit there and, you know, put the lyric up, and within 20 minutes he'd written a song. And sometimes they were amazing, and then sometimes they were not so amazing. But, I mean, the people who around him at one point say that they remembered him sitting one morning and almost auto-writing Rocketman, and just said it was incredible, like, how this thing came together. And yet again, Rocketman's an amazing lyric as well, right? Because it's just this sense of sort of sad adventure and alienation, and it's almost like a near future thing. I mean, it's not like, you know, hundreds or thousands of years in the future. It's you know, it's one of those things that in the 70s they could probably imagine that people would be doing this, you know, trip to Mars, you know, like a long distance lorry driver, right, in 50 years time or something, right? I mean, I did ask them at one point, both of them, what's the worst album that you've made, you know? And both of them immediately, right, had things to nominate, you know. So, I mean, I think as Bernie says at one point in the book, he says, look, he says, you're not going to turn out roses all the time. He says, there's going to be some toilet flushers amongst them.
Well, even Rocket Man, which is a great song and I love it, but that line about, my friend of mine always points out, that line about Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell and there's no one there to raise them if you did.
I know, that's a bad ropey, isn't it?
That's a bad lyric. But it's a great song. We love this song. It's a great song.
But hey, man, I mean, sometimes rock and roll is just a wop, bop, a loo, bop, a wop, bam, boom, you know what I mean?
That's right, right, right. Why do we care? In fact, one of the things I love about both your books is that they're not critical analysis of the work as much as a career, you know, spanning, or at least in this decade-spanning format that you use, and telling us all the things that happen, and they're all pretty fantastic stories. And in fact, the book begins with this marvelous moment in which John Lennon joins Elton John on stage. Tell us about that.
Oh, well, this is incredible, really. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that it shows you the speed that things happened, right? So, I mean, Elton, as Reg, I mean, we'll join him at the beginning of the book as Reg, right? And he's just living a really sort of pretty dull suburban life. I mean, he goes and plays soccer, you know, goes to the movies, all this sort of stuff. And then, obviously, he's been signed on, right, as a singer-songwriter, right, with DGM, which is quite a small label in London, so it wasn't, you know, like he had any money, he was still living with his parents, and all this sort of stuff. And anyway, there's this very funny bit where he goes to this fair, and he wins these two goldfish, right, swimming around in a bag, and he calls them John and Yoko. Now, I actually traced, right, on the timeline, and exactly to the day, 4.5 years later, he's in New York and in a limousine with John Lennon, and they're going to Madison Square Garden, and Lennon is going to appear with Elton on stage. Now, and you just think, that's only 4.5 years. I mean, 4.5 years ago seems like nothing to me now, you know? It's just like, well, I mean, it doesn't seem any different, you know? So I find this quite an astounding thing, actually. And so to just show this contrast to exactly what was going on, you know, that, and so basically, you know, he called the goldfish John and Yoko, and then the next day they died, he's like very upset, you know, which he scribbled into his diary. And basically, like, the 4.5 years ago later, he gets up on stage with John Lennon, and Yoko is in the audience, and obviously at this point they are estranged, and Lennon had been going through his lost weekend in LA and stuff like that, and Yoko comes back stage, and as soon as John sees her again, he sort of feels these emotions stir for her, and then the next thing they get back together. So, you know, the point that I make in the book is like, okay, the goldfish John and Yoko were long dead and buried, but Elton, the superstar, had suddenly, 4.5 years later, had a hand in reuniting the actual John and Yoko. And I put this to Elton, and I, you know, obviously he's an enthusiastic swearer, and I won't repeat what he says, but it's sort of like, wow, my life was incredible, and it certainly was, actually. And I find that point sort of illustrated that really well, actually. And it was one of the sort of great things to write as a writer, because I know that I've blown it as a spoiler alert for your readers here, but, I mean, if you just pick the book up, it says, it's a bit of a magic trick, really. It's just like, whoa, this is exactly what happened. And it shows you the scale of what happened to him and the time period as well, you know. So, but yeah, just your general point about the critical thing. I mean, it is actually kind of intentional not to, because in my sort of day job of writing for rock magazines, I do find myself obviously having to write these, you know, sometimes huge reviews and really going into things. And critical analysis is great in rock books, but I find that, you know, it's one of those things that I think sometimes people like to weigh rock books. It's like, oh, here's the new book on such and such, and it's 850 pages long. And you just think, what? You know, I mean, I'm reading a book at the moment, and I'll not say who wrote it or who it's about, but really, it's all about in-depth critical analysis of every song, every song. And it's not even really placed into context of where the person's life was at that point. And, you know, and then you'll get this incredible story which is told within the space of a paragraph or something. And then we're back onto the in-depth critical analysis of the... And that's great, you know, I mean, I think that there is obviously a place for people who want to pull apart the tunes and understand that. And I mean, I do that actually in my writing in other places. But in terms of these books, I just thought, no, I'm going to go against that format actually, and I'm going to make rock books pacey, right? So it's like the whole idea of the page turning rock biography, you know, which I feel sometimes is lacking in other things, not to overly be critical, but I held up the standard sort of model, which, as we know, you know, I'm not, again, naming any writers or whatever, is that sort of deep, deep, deep analysis. And I thought, no, I'm going to flip it on its head and really just go for this thing, you know, because I would like people to read my books about Elton and Paul McCartney who don't normally read rock books, you know. And I have heard this, actually, that people will pass it to people, say, you know, I know you don't like Elton John, but check this book out, you know. And for me, it's not even just a thing about sales or whatever, it's just maybe bucking the sort of format, which I think sometimes with rock books becomes kind of very weighty and dry as a snake, I would say, is the phrase, you know. It's so, I mean, I'm glad that you like the idea that it's more pacey and it's more sort of episodic and it's more scene-based, you know. I mean, it's one of those things that I always just think, you know, can I speed this scene up a wee bit? You know, I mean, it's like in the McCartney book, the courtroom drama bit, right, of it. I mean, everything that I'd read about the Beatles court case when they split up, right, was really, honestly, you get 6 pages and you're nodding off. And I thought to myself, if people watch, like, John Grisham or read the books, you know, I mean, it's all courtroom drama. And I thought, well, what that is really, he said this, they said that, you know, so it's argument, counter-argument, blah, 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 and then moments of drama where there are breakthroughs and stuff like that. And I thought, can I do that with the Beatles court case? And I'm not sure if I did, but I tried, you know. So it is that thing that is just, yeah, pushing the story along, episodic, you know, scene by scene. That's really what I'm interested in when it comes to rock biographies.
And you've accomplished it well in both of these books, so now I'm wondering what's next for Tom Doyle.
Well, I'm wondering that too. No, I mean, I'm having a think. I've got a few ideas, actually. I mean, there's one of them is, you know, is a 70s book, and that would definitely be the last one. That would be the end of the 70s trilogy, if you would imagine such a thing. There's another one that's based in the 90s. I'm not quite sure at this point exactly what I'm going to do. It's one of those things that you've got to be sure that you want to spend a year thinking about this person, you know, because as much as the books are, you know, I like the books to be between 250 and 300 pages, you know, and to keep that sort of, keep it nice and tight. But at the same time, the research is unbelievable that goes into these things. I mean, I spend far more time than I should, really, on these things. So I'm not quite sure what the next one will be, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of watch this space.
Well, this book is called Captain Fantastic, Elton John's Stellar Trip Through the 70s, and the author is my guest, Tom Doyle. Tom Doyle, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
That's great. Thank you very much, Gary. Cheers, man. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, please check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, rock historian Tom Doyle. His new book, Captain Fantastic, Elton John's Stellar Trip Through the 70s. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next week.